Welcome to the HR Locker podcast. On today's show, we have Katie Ridge, Head of Employer Relations at Adair HRM. Katie's experience lies in employment law, workplace relations investigations, grievance and disciplinary matters, and she also represents organisations in the Workplace Relations Commission and Labour Court. Before joining Adair HRM, she previously worked as a HR practitioner, barrister and employment law consultant. In this podcast, we draw on Katie's vast experience to ask her some hot topics in HR today, such as vaccinations in the workplace, what can or can't employers do, managing remote working requests and the right to disconnect bill, and the code of practice on determining employee status. With hybrid working on the horizon, it is so important to make sure that you are up to date with new bills and legislation, such as the right to disconnect. This is an insightful episode, packed full of great information. We really hope you enjoy it.
Katie, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Katie, while it's not mandatory for people to get vaccinated, can certain employers stipulate that their employees need to be vaccinated?
I think that's a really timely question, and I suppose the starting point is a practical one. And that is a great place to be by noting that the country's heading now towards 3 million citizens being fully vaccinated. So that's a game changer. But of course, we can't leave to one side the basic work safely protocols. They continue to be applicable. In addressing your question in relation to stipulating a vaccination, the position, Crystal, is that the Irish Constitution provides for a fundamental right to bodily integrity. And essentially, that means that you and I have the right to choose to be vaccinated or not to be vaccinated. So employers can highly recommend vaccinations, but they may not force staff to be vaccinated. I think it's also evident at this juncture that there is no indication that the government are contemplating any legislation to support compulsory vaccination.
So Katie, one of the things is at the moment, a lot of the offices are reopening and some companies, I think, are a little bit confused about whether employers can refuse unvaccinated employees actually returning to the workplace. What is the HSA advice at the moment?
Yes, again, and one can understand the space for confusion because we've had a lot of codes and advisories and protocols. But the position is, I suppose, firstly, to recognise that the Health and Safety Authority are working in conjunction with the HSE. And it is the Health and Safety Authority that have determined that employers, in relation to persons coming back into the physical workspace, would have to risk assess the appropriateness for an individual to come back to the workplace to carry out work without being vaccinated. So clearly, there are many, many tasks that the risk would be non-existent or minimal. And in those circumstances, the work safely protocols, washing your hands, being properly segregated, having maybe dividers in the workplace, wearing a mask, all of those initiatives are going to manage the risk assessment for the vast bulk of the working population. So the second step that the HSA are advising, that if on your risk assessment it isn't sufficient to mitigate the risk, then at that juncture an employer may have no option but to redeploy the relevant worker to another work task. Of course, there is always the possibility that there isn't a different work task. And so in those circumstances, an initiative would have to be worked between the employer and the employee. I think what's very important by way of assistance to stress is that if the risk assessment doesn't allow for the ordinary protective measures to mitigate the risk, then however the manner is resolved, it would have to be by way of a consensual agreement between the employer, a medical practitioner, and in consultation with the relevant employee.
So, Katie, you mentioned redeployment there. Can employers suspend employees until they're vaccinated?
Well, in the world of work and the world of people management and HR, the sanction of suspension is one that is rarely used in disciplinary environments. We have a High Court case not relating to vaccination, but in relation to the use of the tool, if I could use that word, of suspension by an employer. In that case, Bank of Ireland versus Riley, it was noted by the presiding judge that suspension is an extremely serious measure, and such a measure can cause irreparable damage to an employee's reputation. And accordingly, holding a suspension should only be used where there is no other way of managing the situation. So it is very difficult to see, given that vaccinations are not compulsory, that an employer could in any way legitimately suspend employees until they are vaccinated.
And I think the main concern for employers and employees at the moment is, what are the dangers for employers in managing unvaccinated employees? Is it something that they should be aware of?
Yeah, well, employers have always had a number of obligations to their staff, not least the duty of care insofar as is reasonably practicable, and that arises under the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work Act. And as we know, the COVID pandemic has thrown into stark relief the significance of providing a safe workplace. So that duty continues with the added, I suppose, considerations of working with COVID. The other issue that employers need to be aware of in relation to having different treatments, perhaps, even if they're unintended, but if the net result is somebody is treated differently by their employer as a consequence of not being vaccinated, one has to remember the Employment Equality Acts provide for equal treatment of employees, or indeed applicants for employment. And that act prohibits discrimination on 9 protected grounds. And it could be the case, for example, that an employee has a health condition that contraindicates them from having the vaccine, or they may have a religious belief that inhibits that, or, although less likely because we have moved so quickly through the age cohorts with the vaccination, it may be that somebody as a consequence of age hasn't been able to access a vaccination. So we need to be very cognizant in our treatment of all of the workforce, or indeed any applicants for employment, that we're not treating people in a discriminatory manner, because clearly there are protections available to employees who would be able to maintain that they were treated differently around vaccination or non-vaccination, and that they had a legitimate right not to be vaccinated for the reasons that I've referred to. So really, it's about being even-handed and complying with the work safety protocol.
I think that's important to remember, Katie, isn't it? That sometimes it is outside of the employee's control whether they're vaccinated or not. It isn't just purely people who aren't vaccinated. Can any employee request to work remotely, and what is the process for making such requests?
Yeah, again, this is a very new development, a welcome one in terms of work-life balance. The starting point, really, Crystal, for any reference to this issue is the National Remote Work Strategy, because this document sets out the roadmap essentially for employers and employees. At this juncture, there's no detail set out in the strategy in terms of the proposed obligations on employers to consider and grant the request for remote working. There isn't a legislative framework dealing with the right to request remote working arrangements, but the plan to introduce that is imminent, i.e. by September 2021. So it is presumed or likely that the proposed provisions regarding a worker's right to request remote working will probably be aligned with similar existing facilities around flexible working arrangements when parents come back from parental leave. So in that existing scenario, the returning parent is entitled to make a request of an employer in relation to flexible working arrangements. The employer is obligated to consider the request and to give a response within a defined period. So it's expected that the same criteria would be used in respect of remote working. So I suppose it is important, however, to say at this point that there isn't any obligation to grant the request.
And that, I suppose, fits in with my next question, Katie, is that can an employer refuse an employee's request to work remotely? And are there any potential consequences for the refusal?
Yeah, so if we think about it in terms of the parental leave construct that is there at the moment, the remote working strategy is essentially not creating a right to work remotely, but giving the right to request remote work. There's a significant difference in that. So it is likely that there will be provisions in the legislation, which, as I know, is contemplated for September, and those would include conditions around an employer's right to refuse the request. And there may also be rights put in there for employees who are enabled to have a right of action against their employer, perhaps when the request is unreasonably refused. But all of the detail has yet to emerge in the legislative instrument.
But I think the most important thing is, it's the right to request, not the right, isn't it? That's the key difference there.
Yes, and unfortunately, in some of the coverage, that nuance hasn't been highlighted. But nonetheless, it is a piece of legislation that many people are looking forward to. It's another, I suppose, a facility that may contribute to better work-life balance for people.
Yeah. One of the things that came out at the same time, Katie, is that we've heard a lot about the right to disconnect. What does this mean? How should employers implement this code of practice in their workplace?
Yes, so the legislature have been busy in terms of, as you say, a number of new initiatives have been flown, and one of them is this right to disconnect. So this is a code of practice, in effect, and it was implemented back on the 1st of April this year. And the code defines the right to disconnect. And interestingly, it describes it as an employee's right to be able to disengage from work and to refrain from engaging in work-related electronic communication, so email, telephone calls, or other types of messaging. And of course, they're able to refrain from this activity outside of normal working hours. There are three, I suppose, main threads to this right to disconnect, and you could summarise them as the right not to routinely work beyond an agreed overtime period, the right not to be penalised for refusing to work beyond your contractual time, and then, I suppose, an important one culturally is a duty to respect the other person's right to disconnect. Now, failure to follow this code that is up and running is not an offence, but the code is admissible in evidence before courts, particularly the Labour Court or indeed the Workplace Relations Commission. The code provides that employers should really implement a right to disconnect policy. And the document itself is quite helpful in terms of what elements should be covered in that policy. Of course, the policy, like any other worthwhile policy, should be done in consultation with the workforce. But I suppose in brief, Crystal, one should be looking at equality proofing the policy to avoid unintended consequences. You need to obviously take into consideration manager, needs to think about the customer expectation and the client expectation vis-a-vis maybe a new regime that this right to disconnect is going to produce. There needs to be some oversight in terms of how the policy is working, and it should be reviewed. Many of our viewers will be working in multinational entities, and so there may be global time zones that need to be taken into consideration. And with any policy that we introduce, we need to train and support people in the implementation. Again, back to the cultural element of it, I think it's very important that within the policy, if you like, the spirit of it is that there isn't going to be any favourable treatment for people who stay connected, and examples may be made of people who abide by their right to disconnect.
And I think key there, Katie, again, is that you don't just throw out a policy. It has to be in consultation with employees, and training has to go into account and explain to people what actually it is and what's expected.
Yes, and I think it's very, this is a policy that the introduction of it will be felt across the entity, because there is an existing culture, and other than in a small pocket of very compliant organisations, that existing culture may have tipped into bad practices, particularly, though not exclusively, as a consequence of the pandemic and remote working. So it may be that this policy needs to rebalance the culture of the organisation. So definitely needs buy-in, needs to be reviewed and monitored. And like anything else, if it isn't working, then it needs to be rejigged. And also it needs to be, people need to be reminded of it in terms of this new way of working.
Yes, most definitely. So, Katie, one of the big question is, what is the purpose of the updated code of practice, and why has it been updated?
That's a very pertinent question in terms of the world of work and how the law views people in relation to the arrangement that they have with an entity to carry out work. So the purpose of the code of practice is to set out key characteristics to inform decisions that are made in-house, maybe in relation to employment rights, or revenue or social welfare considerations around the status of an individual. So the updating has been necessary because law always follows developments in society, and there have been a number of new developments in relation to labour market practices. So these developments, for example, would include new forms of work like platform work, where workers are engaged in an app, and the gig economy. And so what the code of practice is designed to do is to take this new working scenario that we haven't had formally notified previously, and to allow analysis to take place of persons who are working in this new environment. And then decisions can be made as to the correct employment status of those persons.
And Katie, why is it important that we have someone's employment status correctly classified?
Yeah, it's really important in terms of classifying a worker into the correct identity, in terms of being able to decide clearly, for the purposes usually of rights and benefits, as to whether the person working is in fact an employee, or are they a self-employed individual. So the activity of classifying a worker as either self-employed or an employee has implications for the employment protections that they are afforded in relation to PRSI and tax that they may be liable for, and social welfare rights that are afforded to them. Also, the status of an employee in terms of whether they are an employee or an independent contractor is important when it comes to something like the winding up of a company and the status of those workers in that particular event. So it's quite far reaching, and the implications can be that you can have two people working side by side. They may not know their employment status, and an event happens to one or other of those individuals, or maybe a universal event like the winding up of that employment, and all of a sudden the relevance of their employment status is thrown into sharp relief. So it's a very important piece of information for anybody who's carrying out work.
Okay. And, you know, so ultimately, whose responsibility is it to determine employment status?
Yeah, so in relation to the operation of the employment relationship, it is the entity who engages the service of the worker that is obligated to ensure that they apply the correct tax, social insurance and employment law treatment of that particular worker. And if that is done intentionally or unintentionally, obviously there can be outcomes that the employer will have to deal with in relation to perhaps liability for arrears in any taxes that were due, or there may be loss of earnings or other benefits that would accrue and would have to be backdated and discharged to somebody who was incorrectly classified. So the status is very important in terms of the entity discharging all of their compliance duties, and I suppose the other side of that coin being the worker getting the benefits of all of the treatments and that they are entitled to depending on their work status.
So very important in terms of responsibility, but also there's severe consequences if you're getting it wrong down the line.
Yeah, and I think that the updated code of practice will be a very helpful document, because we have had a code of practice. We've had an informal checklist, as it were, for many years that would assist people if they were trying to determine if I'm taking somebody in to do work for me, and these are the parameters of that arrangement. Does that mean that that person is an independent contractor or an employee? So this is a welcome update because of the developments like the gig economy, and we've seen plenty of case law happen in relation to people who've been working in that space and them looking to assert rights in terms of employment law benefits and other benefits.
Yes. So thank you so much, Katie. That was really helpful. And I'm wondering if anybody needs to get in contact with yourself or anybody from Adair, what is the best way for them to do that?
Sure. Yes. The best way would be to contact us at info@adairhrm.ie.
Thank you so much, Katie.
Thanks for listening. Check us out at hrlocker.com. The show was hosted by Christelle Rinn and produced by Jenny Martin. Subscribe to catch the latest episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. If you'd like to feature, get in touch by emailing us at marketing@hrlocker.com. You can also follow HR Locker on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.